from the safety of the command module, so there was no need to go down that ice tunnel and open that hatch. Their instruments told them they were nearing perigee again. Jiro, assisted by Dinah, executed what they hoped would be the second-to-last burn of the big engine. This went on longer than Jiro had predicted, but it seemed to work. Ymir shed most of her excess velocity. Her orbit, at apogee, was now only a few hundred kilometers higher than Izzy's. In spite of attrition suffered by the robots as they wore out, broke, or succumbed to radiation damage, Dinah still had enough of them to restock the hoppers for the final major burn, which they calculated would be happening at a perigee a few hours later. "If you are satisfied with the disposition of your robots," Jiro said, "I would like to show you how to operate the main propulsion." She had grown up in mining camps where older men liked to amuse her, and themselves, by teaching her how to operate heavy machinery, blow things up with dynamite, pilot airplanes, and the like. So Jiro's offer didn't seem unusual to her at first. Teaching people how to do stuff was, among other things, a way to alleviate boredom. But over the course of the next hour, it slowly became clear to her that Jiro really was expecting her to operate the engine during the upcoming burn. It might have been the language barrier, but his English was pretty good, and he was being quite persistent in saying things like, "You will keep an eye on this thermocouple," and "You might see some flutter in this valve." "If you don't hear from me beyond the 30-second mark," he said at one point, "then you are on your own and you will have to initiate shutdown based on observed Delta V. "Why would I not hear from you?" Dinah asked. "Where are you going to be?" "In the boiler room," Jiro said. "Why would you go there?" "Some of the control blade actuators have stopped responding," he said. "I think that the electronics have been damaged by radiation. It's okay. We have replacements. But they will have to be installed manually." "So you're going to go down there?" "Yes," Jiro said. "And that is where I am going to stay."
"It is, for all intents and purposes, empty,"
Tekla reported over an encrypted voice link to Ivy.
"Empty of people. Empty of supplies."
She, Tom Van Meter, and Bowler Erdina had spent the last 10 minutes searching Arklet 98, from front door to boiler room, under the eye of Sal Guodian. They had arrived via Flivver, docked, and entered 98 without incident. Sal had gone through first, carrying a tablet on which was displayed the first search warrant ever issued under the provisions of the Cloud Art Constitution. He had been ready to show it to the first person who challenged him, but no one was here. Tekla, Tom, and Beau had then come in, wearing orange vests improvised from survival kits that, since they'd been designed for use on Earth, had no practical utility anymore. These would serve as police uniforms until something else could be stitched together. With any luck, they wouldn't be needing a lot of cop gear. But Ivy had been clear, and the others in her ad hoc council had agreed, that if they were executing what amounted to a police action, they couldn't beat around the bush, couldn't try to palm it off as an informal visit. A new constitution had to be exercised, or it was just words.
"Can you get it back on the SAN?"
Ivy asked, over the voice link. "I'd like to see what's happening."
"I'll reboot everything,"
Sal said, pulling himself up into the control couch.
"But it depends on what Spencer did, whether he broke it permanently or just entered a temporary command."
He reached around in back of a panel, felt for a connector, pulled it out, and jacked it back in.
"We had estimated that you were going to find 10 person-years worth of non-renewables in that thing,"
Ivy said. She meant not bulk food, which could be grown in the outer hull space of an arklet, or air, which was renewed by the life support system, but generally smaller items, like toiletries, vitamins, medicine, and specialty food.
"That was based on circumstantial evidence, the amount of stuff that's gone missing, the number of flivver trips and EVAs that have touched that arklet. We always knew it was only a guess. But for it to contain nothing at all is... odd.
More than odd, Teclis said. Surprise attack.
You think there's going to be an attack?
Maybe not in sense of violent assault, Teclis said, but something.
And Arklet 98 was a decoy,
obviously.
A musical tone sounded from the Arklet's PA speakers, and the white LEDs changed their hue to red.
Alert, said a synthesized voice. All personnel should now be awake and at stations for urgent swarm maneuver. This is not a drill.
They'd heard it before. It was a streaker alert. Normally, though, they took it at face value.
Remarkable coincidence,
Tekla said. I think you guys had better get back in the flivver, Ivy said. Follow the usual procedures for one of these, but keep your eyes open.
Steve, do you have anything yet on the bolide?
Ivy asked. They were about 5 minutes into the alert, which had obliged them to move down into the banana. As much as Ivy wanted to know what was happening with JBF and what Tekla had characterized as a surprise attack, her responsibility in a case like this one was clear. All of her attentions had to be focused on the evasive maneuvers being carried out by the Cloud Ark and their possible consequences. Those might include collisions between arklets or the separation of one or more arklets from the swarm. In dire cases, it might be necessary to send out rescue teams, which was why her first act had been to get Tekla and the others into their flivver. For the normal role of that makeshift police service was not to serve warrants on hoarders. It was to respond to emergencies. As keenly as the space geek in Ivy's soul wanted to pay attention to the scientific phenomenon of the incoming rock, it was a task she had to delegate. And she delegated it to Steve Lake as soon as the alert had sounded. Thus far, the alert had been proceeding as most of them did, which meant that most network activity had been shut down to leave open bandwidth for Perambulator. That system swung into action without human intervention, calculating courses, making suggestions, and gathering data about what the motes in the data cloud were doing. The Perambulator screens were looking pretty angry, but that was normal as almost every arclet fired its thrusters and shunted into a new trajectory. In time, it would get sorted out. It always did. But part of the sorting out process was refining what they knew about the trajectory of the incoming streaker. The closer it came, the more precisely they could track it. By the time it passed through, or near, the swarm, they'd have its parameters dialed in to high precision. And once it had flashed by, all Perambulator had to do was clean up the mess. Ivy had asked Steve about the bolide for a couple of reasons. One was that hot rocks, by definition, tended to come and go rapidly. This one had been approaching for several minutes, a long time to wait. Another was that Perambulator looked more chaotic than usual. Normally, there would be a spray of red in the first couple of minutes. Presently, it would begin to fade as the arklets reported that they were out of harm's way. But in this case, it never seemed to get any better.
Are we having trouble with bandwidth, or...
The rock is weird, Steve said. Normally I'd expect to see a stream of packets from SI, refining the params as they gathered more data.
He meant sensor integration, the department that managed the radars and telescopes.
And you're not.
Well, I am, but with different numbers.
What do you mean, different numbers?
It's like we have two different streaker alerts happening at once. The packets are stepping on each other. There's some kind of crosstalk going on.
Steve sat back from his screen for a moment and tugged his beard.
Just a sec, he said. I think that these packets are coming from different sources.
But they should all have the same point of origination, Ivy said. SI.
They claim to, Steve said. But I think that some of them are forgeries.
Feeling his chair shift subtly beneath him, he reached out involuntarily with one hand and held the edge of the table. Izzy was firing her thrusters, coming about to a new orientation, trying to put Amalthea between herself and the bolide, real or imagined.
You think this whole alert is them spoofing us?
It would fit with Tekla's theory of what's going on, Steve said.
I'll try to voice with Doob, Ivy said. Work on that forgery hypothesis.
Madam President, Camilla said, pulling a headphone away from her ear.
As you requested, I am informing you that Ivy has figured it out.
She knows, Julia asked.
Not quite, but Steve Lake has detected the forged packets and is running further analysis.
Camilla's eyes were big, and her voice, which was always somewhat impaired by her facial injuries, was thick and dry.
Julia threw her a shrewd look, then turned to Spencer Grindstaff, who shrugged.
Sooner or later, a man of Steve's talents was bound to...
I don't care about that, Julia cut in. I want to know whether our gambit has bought us enough time. There's...
Camilla began. Spencer ran Camilla off the road.
It has bought us enough confusion. We should be in position to dock this heptad at the shipyard in 20 seconds.
There's another bolide,
Camilla squeaked, I think.
Julia shook her off, keeping her focus on Spencer.
Where is the triad?
Already there, Spencer said.
The spacewalkers?
Suited up, out of the airlocks, in position.
Still, the assembly, the integration, it will take time.
Madam President, if I may.
Paul Friel broke in.
All we need is to slap her together, with zip ties if that's what it takes, and achieve separation from the shipyard. A small thruster burn will do it. Izzy doesn't have phasers to blast us out of the sky. They could send a flivver after us, but what are they going to do? All we need is to get clear. Then we can spend days prepping Red Hope before we embark on the mission in earnest.
I wouldn't put anything past that Tekla.
Say what you will about her. She'll follow orders.
Paul said.
Well, as a stay-behind supporter of your expedition, I will be happy to run interference for you until you can get cleanly away, Julia said.
Through the heptad structure, a programmed series of whirs and clunks resonated as it docked with a port on the long truss projecting to the side of the caboose, the heart of the shipyard, rich in airlocks and anchoring points. Docked at the next port along was a glinting, angular framework, the skeleton of Red Hope, awaiting its final components. It sported four large propellant tanks, clustered around a knot of pumps, valves, actuators, and sensors that fed a rocket engine centered below.
"Madam President," Ravi asked, "I am afraid the time is now, unless you want to go to Mars, which you would be welcome to do."
Julia snapped to attention. She had been checking herself in the mirror of her compact. Hardly glamorous, but by Cloud Arc standards, her appearance would do.
"It is tempting," Julia said, "but I have responsibilities here, I'm afraid."
She snapped the compact shut and glanced over,
verifying that Camilla was ready to shoot video on her phone.
She was, but she still had that rattled look on her face. What had come over her? They'd have to have a heart-to-heart later.
"Very well," Ravi said, with a note of regret that sounded only a little forced. "Perhaps you'll be wanting this."
He held out a sheet of paper. Taking it from him, Julia recognized it as the presidential seal, much the worse for wear. Ravi had carefully peeled it from the wall, bringing most of its rectangle of blue tape with it. Julia smoothed it out and tucked it under one arm. Drifting slowly away from her, Ravi snapped out a salute. Julia returned it.
"Godspeed, Ravi. I look forward to hearing your first transmission from the surface of Mars."
"And I look forward to sending it, Madam President."
"We shall meet again, I feel. Somehow the intrepid people of the Cloud Arc will find a way, in spite of all opposition, to win through to the realm of clean space and follow Red Hope to a better place."
Ravi was one of those who could never quite tell when he was being dismissed. He began to mumble out a stirring response,
but Julia glanced at Camilla to let her know that she could stop recording, then propelled herself toward the nose of the white arclet. Camilla followed in her wake.
After a few moments of squirming through tubes, they emerged from the port into one of the modules that made up the shipyard. It was something of a madhouse. The total roster of the Red Hope expedition was 24. Most of those were already aboard the Heptad or the Triad, waiting to be mated with the vehicle's frame. But a few were outside in spacesuits, and several were in here, engaging in hasty conferences or shoving bundles of supplies about. Adding a bizarre note were four members of the general population, apparently shipyard workers, who had been zip-tied, hands behind backs, to convenient attachment points around the inside of the module. Most looked fine, but one man had a stream of small blood globules drifting away from a laceration on his eyebrow. Paul Friel had mentioned in passing that several of the MIV team had become unwitting accomplices, helping to assemble the frame of Red Hope on the understanding that it was part of a backup plan to rescue Ymir. Apparently, they had changed status to witting and raised objections. The bleeding man was staring at Julia through the eye that hadn't swollen shut. "Julia!" he called out. In an odd way, Julia had nothing to do. The other Martians were busy shoving their hoarded supplies through the port into the Heptad. One by one, the Martians were following suit, and so the space was rapidly clearing out. She ignored the bleeding man at first, but it got to the point where only one Martian, Paul Friel himself, was remaining. Lacking Ravi's feel for ceremony, he was checking off items on the screen of his tablet, paying Julia no attention whatsoever.
"Julia!"
the zip-tied man said again. He wasn't shouting. His tone was almost conversational. "Yes?" she finally said.
"What's your friend's name?"
he asked, nodding toward Camilla. Julia bridled for a moment at the impertinent request, then remembered that it was never too late to turn an enemy into a friend.
"Her name is Camilla," she said, "and let me say, sir, that I am shocked and dismayed to see what has occurred to you. Let me assure you that..."
"Hey, Camilla," the man said.
"Yes," Camilla answered, sounding very much the scared 18-year-old girl.
"Your friend is crazy," the man told her. "Madam President," Paul asked, before Julia had time to react.
She turned toward Paul, her face burning.
"If you would do the honors."
"What honors? Honestly, these engineers, was she supposed to break a bottle of champagne over it?"
"Close the hatch when I've gone through. Then we can undock."
"Happy to."
"See you on Mars."
He stuck his hand out. She grasped it lightly and gave it a little shake. Camilla, rattled by the exchange with the bleeding man, had forsaken her duties as camera operator. Paul Friel reached into the portal, joining Earth to Mars, pulled himself through, turned about, and closed the hatch on his side. Julia followed suit on hers. Immediately she felt, as much as heard, the hisses and clunks that signaled the undocking of Red Hope. Unfamiliar noises radiated through the module's hull, too, very close to her, and she realized that these were the boots of spacesuits moving around.
"The alert is canceled,"
announced a synthetic voice. The color of the lights changed.
Camilla emitted a short, explosive scream. Then she pointed down the length of the shipyard toward where it connected with the stack. Down in the caboose, some 30 meters away, a few people could be seen, dressed in orange vests. One of them looked directly at her. It was Tekla. The synthesized voice spoke out again, sounding a second alert. That wasn't part of the plan. Tekla must have gathered her legs against something down in the caboose, capable of pushing back, because all of a sudden she was flying toward them like a rocket. Her arms were in motion, reaching this way and that to slap at anything that could help her correct her course. But her eyes were fixed on Julia, and she was coming straight for her. Something gleamed in her hand, a thin arc of silver light, the honed edge of a dagger. A crisp, metallic noise resounded through the module as Julia pulled back the hammer on Pete Starling's revolver.
"Gun!"
shouted the bleeding man. "Gun!
Gun!"
If Tekla heard, she did not care, but only pushed back harder against a strut in the neighboring module and came on faster. To Julia, the weapon's recoil came too soon, as if it had gone off accidentally. She'd been in space long enough to know that it would knock her back, and it did. But she also saw things she could not explain. Camilla had entered the picture, flying in from the side with an arm outstretched. The wall of the shipyard itself reached out to body check Tekla. A moment later it struck Camilla, then Julia. She had expected the high-pitched hiss of a bullet-sized hull puncture, but what followed was more like a roar, like the crowd in a football stadium when a pass is intercepted. Camilla's arm had turned into a wing of fire. Something took Julia from behind and hurled her toward the caboose. She looked around, thinking crazily that the bleeding man had somehow gotten loose and tackled her. But the force pushing her along was no human being. It was a torrent of escaping air. "Jiro, can you hear me?" Dinah asked for the fourth time. She conjectured that he could, but that he was simply too weak to answer. So she went ahead and delivered the good news. "We made it," she said. "I have Izzy on optical. We'll converge with them in about half an hour."
"Good," he said. "Good."
She was startled to hear anything at all, but the second good was a lot fainter than the first one, and she reckoned it was all he could get out. She decided not to tell him anything further. Entombed in Ymir's boiler room, simultaneously freezing to death while being cooked alive by radiation, he didn't need to hear a description of what Dinah was seeing through the telescope. They had been calling this the Cloud Ark for 2 years. The name had meant something poetically. Today, however, it really did look like a cloud. Her view of Izzy, which usually was so crisp and sharp in the high-contrast light of outer space, was cloaked in a glinting and winking shroud of what might be clinically described as particulate matter. It went without saying that Izzy had taken a direct hit from a bolide. Beyond that, it was difficult to make out details. Ymir's final burn, for Jiro, a suicide mission, had settled her in an orbit quite similar to Izzy's. The same plane, the same average altitude. The only difference was that it was a little bit more oval, calculated to cross Izzy's path twice during each revolution around the Earth. They were approaching one of those crossings, and so from Dinah's point of view, the space station kept getting closer, filling the window on her computer screen, obliging her to zoom out, giving her a progressively sharper, more detailed picture. As minutes ticked by, she was able to piece together a guess as to what had happened. The rock must have come in from an angle, missed Amalthea cleanly, and struck somewhere near H2, the hub that anchored Tauri 2 and 3. Both of the Tauri had huge bites taken out of them, and both had stopped rotating. Aft of that point, Izzy's spine, her central stack, was actually bent. The spreading wings of the shipyard were still attached to the caboose, but they were askew and leaking debris. The original Taurus, the one that contained the banana, was still rotating and looked whole, but as she drew closer, she saw it had taken damage, perhaps from shrapnel. A faint thud resounded through the ice hull. They'd probably struck a piece of jetsam. No matter. It wouldn't be moving very fast. Ymir could nuzzle her way through a cloud of that stuff and never feel it. One of the windows on her screen flashed up a video feed, triggered by the motion detector on a grab's camera, and she saw a human body drifting away into space. She swallowed against a sharp contraction of her throat. Part of her wondered if she would find Izzy a ghost ship, if she were the only human remaining alive. For Vyacheslav had stopped communicating with them yesterday. Before then, he had mentioned that he had been suffering from diarrhea. If this was caused by radiation exposure, it was a death sentence. He might simply have committed suicide rather than wait for the inevitable. Alone at the controls of Ymir, she coasted toward Izzy, silent and adrift in the cosmos, and entertained the thought, just for a while, that she might be the only human being left in the universe. Then a red light, a laser aimed right at her, began to flash from the mining colony, and her mind began to pick out Morse code. Sending flivvers to effect final maneuvers. Disregard stray arclets. Welcome home. Lacking any way to respond, she waited and watched. Shreds of insulation, scraps of structural material, spilled vitamins, and the occasional body tumbled across the window as she panned and zoomed over various details. Everything forward of Zvezda looked pretty good. The mining colony and Moira's stash of genetic equipment appeared to be unscathed. Good. Three flivvers had separated themselves from the cloud and established trajectories that would bring them to Ymir within a few minutes. She guessed that they would act as tugboats, butting their heads against the shard and using their main engines to effect the final delta V needed to achieve rendezvous. So the first part of the transmission made sense. Disregard stray arclets, however, was something of a mystery. Why would there be such a thing? What did it mean, anyway, for an arclet to be stray? And yet, as Dinah panned the telescope across the arc of space forward and aft of Izzy, the realm where most of the arclets normally parked themselves, she found it curiously underpopulated. It was just a general visual impression. She couldn't verify it scientifically without access to a perambulator screen. It occurred to her then that all she needed to do was switch on her tablet's connection to the mesh network. Shortly after New Caird's departure from Izzy, she had turned it off because, once they got out of range, it was a useless battery drainer. And indeed, the tablet soon brought up the little icon announcing it had found a connection, perhaps relayed through one of those flivvers. A minute or two went by as the device downloaded all the email and message traffic that had been piling up in her inbox during her vacation. She passed the time playing with the telescope. A detail caught her eye as she panned across the scene, and she went back and zoomed in on it for a closer look. It was a MIV, an unusually big one. Basically a five-layer stack, wasp-waisted. The bottom layer was an engine of the most powerful class in the MIV toolkit. Above that was a fat cluster of propellant tanks. The third layer, the narrow waist, was a single arclet with an airlock on its side. A command module, she guessed, similar to New Caird's. Above that was a triad, and on top, forming the fat head of the vehicle, was a heptad. All of it was shrouded in structural webbing. Snared like little bugs in the edges of that web were small modules that she recognized as attitude control thrusters. The most notable thing about the vehicle was her outsized propellant tanks, hinting at a long journey. To where? The thing was keeping station several kilometers forward of Izzy, in a region that had been largely denuded of arclets. Her tablet finally finished downloading messages, most of which were long out of date by this point. She sorted them by age, newest first, and scanned the headings. Very few had come through in the last several hours. That stood to reason, given that the cloud arc had other things on its mind. But close to the top was one that caught her eye. Open communique from President JBF to the people of the cloud arc. Merely seeing those words gave her a feeling as if she'd been socked in the solar plexus. She tapped it anyway and read it. Today's shocking tragedy has left us all bereaved and seeking answers. I was in a shipyard module when it happened, having just bid farewell and godspeed to the brave explorers of the Red Hope expedition. Thanks to the automatic closure of a hatch, I experienced only minor injuries and discomfort from partial decompression. As we all know, many members of the general population were not so lucky. I join with all humanity in mourning their sacrifice. By its nature, the Archie community was less affected by this disaster. As I had envisioned from the very beginnings of the Cloud Arc project, the distributed architecture of the swarm prevented serious damage. We did lose 3 arclets, I am sorry to say, and several more sustained damage from minor collisions or debris impacts. But overall, the system worked as we had planned from the beginning. Many members of the AC are now, quite naturally, asking themselves whether it is safe to remain in low Earth orbit, clustered around a heavy, aging space station that lacks the ability to maneuver out of harm's way. The open vista of clean space beckons above us. Red Hope will soon fire its main engine and begin its trek across that unexplored frontier to a planet that will one day have room for us all. The Cloud Arc cannot follow her, yet. But as all members of the AC know, having gone through extensive training in space operations and orbital mechanics, it is well within the capability of any arclet to raise its orbit substantially by making use of its engines and its onboard propellant supplies. Alone, a single arclet, triad, or heptad will not long endure. As part of a swarm, however, it has a fighting chance. Many members of the Archie community who have been watching the desperate trials and tribulations of the Ymir expedition and who have now witnessed the damage inflicted upon Izzy by a single bolide are now asking themselves whether it is safe to remain and to trust themselves to the agonizingly slow climb toward clean space envisioned by the partisans of the Big Ride faction. I'm a politician, not a scientist, and so I cannot pretend to render a technical opinion. Some may question whether I should be making a public announcement at all. The simple fact of the matter is that my past career as President of the United States has given me prominence in the Archie community, whether or not I deserve it. Many have been asking me what I shall do now. Rather than wait for rumor to sow confusion, I am therefore issuing this communique. For what it is worth, I have, with the assistance of some loyal friends, escaped from the wreckage of Izzy and found safe haven aboard Arclet 37, currently part of a triad. Shortly after I transmit this message, we will initiate a burn of our main propulsion that will lift us clear of the drifting debris that surrounds what was once the International Space Station and move us in the direction of clean space. Our orbital parameters will be posted openly on the network so that like-minded members of the AC may join us in creating a swarm-based solution to the acute problems currently imposing themselves on the human race. From a safe position in higher orbit, we will look for ways to extend a helping hand to our surviving friends marooned in the general population. Working together as a community, we will preserve what we have and build a stable way of life in the sky as we await with breathless anticipation the results of Red Hope's inspiring venture to the welcoming surface of Mars.
She's right about the breathless part of it, Dinah muttered to herself, closing the window and looking at the timestamp again. It had been transmitted 3 hours ago. Then, only half an hour ago, Ivy had responded with a counter-communiqué. Dinah didn't read it, but based on the subject heading, she knew what it would say. Don't listen to JBF. Stay in formation. We need you, and you need us. But from what Dinah was seeing, both through the optical telescope and on perambulator, Ivy's message had come too late to forestall the departure of a large number of arclets. Somewhere out there, up above them in higher orbit, a new swarm was taking shape, running its own independent instance of perambulator and looking to JBF for leadership. Dinah had been through many emotional ups and downs while retrieving Ymir. More downs than ups, of course, given the fatality rate. In a strange way, however, the emotional high point was just a few moments ago when she had scanned the word desperate in JBF's communique. She rather liked being described as desperate, particularly when she was just on the verge of succeeding. Perambulator was working on her screen now. She used it to check the status of those 3 flivvers. They were still closing. Messages were starting to come in from their pilots, trying to make out whether anyone was still alive in the Shard, whether it was safe to approach. Dinah texted back. One survivor. Stand clear for a sec while this thing takes a big glow-in-the-dark crap. Then she pulled up the window she used to communicate with her network of robots and typed in a single-word command. Jettison. It was the name of a program that Sean had started, Lars had improved, and Dinah had recently finished. It was a program meant to be run simultaneously by every robot in the Shard, as well as some other systems down in the boiler room. A prompt came back. Are you sure? Y/in. Why? She typed. Congratulations! Came back. The dead crew of Ymir had sent her a message from the void. She pushed herself over to the companionway, got her head aimed down through the hole in the floor, and pulled herself straight to the bottom level of the command module. The hatch in the floor, the one that led to the ice tunnel that terminated in the boiler room, had already been closed, as a basic safety measure. But Dinah verified that one last time, and made sure it was sealed. Because in a few seconds, there would be nothing but vacuum on the other side of it. Ymir had begun grumbling. Dinah felt as if she were trapped inside the belly of a frost giant with indigestion. What she was hearing, she knew, was the collective noise made by thousands of gnats and hundreds of larger robots as they moved to safe positions on the inner surface of the hollow shard and gnawed away at the structural webbing that connected it to the reactor core. She returned to her seat in the command module and pulled up a video feed from the interior of the shard. Its walls were now thin enough to admit some sunlight, and so it had become a sort of vast, pellucid amphitheater where all of those robots could look inward to the smooth beryllium pod, a neutron-reflecting shroud surrounding the reactor core. Formerly, this had been buried in ice. The recent excavations made to fuel the big perigee burns had left it exposed, also revealing the smaller pod of the boiler room mounted on its side, and the system of hoppers and augers that fed it. Aft of that was what remained of the ice cavern of the nozzle bell, now mostly melted away to expose the blackness of space beyond. The only thing now holding the reactor chamber in place was the massive central thrust pillar, a tree trunk of ice that grew from its forward end and extended straight up to the solid nose of the shard, where the command module was embedded. Jettison did her the courtesy of showing a countdown on the screen so that she could plug her ears. When it hit zero, a sickening crack resounded through the whole structure. The video feed showed a brilliant spray of ice blown free from the central pillar just above where it connected to the reactor vessel. Demolition charges, placed there long ago by Sean's crew, had detonated and severed the connection. For a moment she feared nothing further would happen, but then jets of white steam lanced from the reactor vessel's rounded top. Jettison had opened valves, releasing pressure that had built up in the chamber from the reactor's residual heat. And those valves were now acting as makeshift rocket engines, pushing the whole reactor and everything attached to it down toward the vacancy of the nozzle. The entire reactor chamber dropped out the bottom of the shard and was gone. If Jettison continued to do its work, the reactor, now a free-floating vehicle, all brawn and no brains, would execute a few clumsy maneuvers to kill its own orbital velocity and drop itself into the atmosphere.
Bye, Jiro, Dinah said. Thank you.
One of the Flivver pilots texted her, Wow. Dinah gave it all one more thorough scan, using several cameras. But there wasn't much to see. Ymir was now a hollow, sugar-loaf-shaped shell, crawling with robots and helplessly adrift in space. She texted, Did someone place an order for a megaton of propellant? Instinct had herded them together in the scrum, close to Amalthea and far away from the parts of Izzy that had been damaged or destroyed. That was where Dinah found them, after she'd been brought aboard, scrubbed clean, checked and checked again for contamination. Pink and raw, she embraced Ivy first for a long time, and then made the rounds to Dube, Moira, Reese, Louisa, Steve Lake, Fyodor, and Beau. Conrad Barth and many others were dead. Tekla was still in surgery. One of her breasts had been damaged by a fragment and was being surgically repaired. Curled up, in very nearly a fetal position at one end of the scrum, was a woman who was quietly weeping. She hid her face from the room with an arm swathed, from fingertips to shoulder, in white gauze.
Dinah recognized her as Camilla, Julia's sidekick.
Ivy insisted that they all move back down the stack and meet in the banana.
It took some gentle persuasion to get Camilla to come with them,
but eventually Louisa talked her into it. Out of habit, she kept reaching for the veil she normally drew across the lower half of her face, but it wasn't there anymore. She was dressed like everyone else in a shapeless coverall.
"What is Camilla doing here?"
Dinah asked Moira as they maneuvered down the stack. Moira had obviously been crying and seemed badly shaken up. She and Tekla had become a couple at some point, and Moira was taking the news of her partner's injury hard. "Tekla came for JBF," Moira said, "and JBF tried to shoot her.
Camilla reached out and grabbed for the gun, I guess.
She was always wearing that gauzy wrap as a veil. The fabric caught fire from the flash of the gun and burned her arm before she could get it off." "But she saved Tekla?" "Who knows? The bullet struck something else and fragmented, apparently." The holes where shrapnel had struck T1, the first, oldest, and smallest torus, had been patched, and it had been repressurized. They had always considered it a safe place before. They needed to begin thinking of it in that light again, which was why Ivy had insisted they come here. They took seats in the banana. The numbers had come in. Ivy opened the meeting by reciting them. At the onset of the hard rain, the human population, not counting any who might still be alive on Earth, had been 1,551, or 1,553 if you counted the two late arrivals, Julia and Pete Starling. Starling hadn't even made it out of his space capsule, so the initial number had been 1,552. At the same time, there had been 305 occupied free-flying arklets, plus 11 spares that were attached to Izzy but not occupied. The free-flying ones had housed 1,364 people. The remaining 188 humans had lived aboard Izzy as members of the general population. But at any given time, 10% of the Arkies had been rotating through Izzy, bringing its population on a typical day up to 324. Prior to today's disaster, 26 people had been killed in various mishaps, mostly smaller bolide strikes. Another 24 were now aboard the stolen MIV calling itself Red Hope, and if their claims were taken at face value, they would soon be en route to Mars. Of the persons who had been aboard Izzy at the time of the disaster, 211 had been killed outright, and another 24 or so remained in critical condition. The number of living people aboard Izzy had therefore been reduced to 113. The general population, the older, more experienced, highly trained specialists, had been reduced from 188 to 106. At the moment of the disaster, 1,178 persons had been living in arklets. The distributed nature of the swarm, combined with the fact that many arklets had flown the coop with Julia, made it difficult to estimate casualties. The best estimate they currently had was that 17 arklets had fallen victim, with assumed 100% loss of life, reducing that population to about 1,100. If that was correct, then the day's full death toll had been close to 300. In terms of arclet count, they'd started the day with 299 surviving, occupied arclets, a figure that had been reduced to 282 by the collision. 10 of them, a heptad and a triad, were attached to Red Hope, leaving 272. Approximately 200 were missing and presumed to have flown the coop with JBF. The remaining 70 or so had elected to stay behind and were still reporting in as members in good standing of the Cloud Ark. The 11 spares were still attached to Izzy and would be inspected for damage later. The arclets still with them probably had a population of some 300. That, plus the survivors aboard Izzy, added up to a bit over 400. The population of JBF's breakaway swarm must then be something like 800 souls. She had taken two-thirds of the human race with her.
"God forgive me," Doob said, "but right now I don't even care about headcount. The number I'm after is engines. Arclet engines. Until Dinah showed up with all of that ice, they were useless. Now we have a way to fuel them. If we get them all pointed in the same direction, all pushing on Izzy, we can go on the big ride."
He paused to look at his notes. With his reading glasses down on his nose, he suddenly looked a lot older to Dinah. She could only imagine how she looked.
"Based on what you just told me, am I right in thinking we have..."
"About 70, Ivy said, "plus the 11 spares. We haven't checked those yet, but on visual inspection they seem undamaged."
81,
Doob said.
"I like that number. A perfect square."
"A perfect square of perfect squares," Reese put in.
"If we could come up with a structural system for ganging them in clusters of 9, just a 3x3 grid, with shared propellant feeds, and make 9 of those clusters, and integrate them into Izzy's structure somehow, that being the hard part, then we'd have an array of 81 engines. If those things all come on at full power when we pass through perigee, it'll give us enough combined thrust to make a difference. I think we can make the big ride work with that level of power."
"It's a lot of structure," Fyodor pointed out. "A lot, a lot, a lot."
"We have a lot of raw materials to work with, don't we?" Louisa asked. "I've seen rolls and rolls of that aluminum ribbon for feeding into the extruder machines."
"It is a question of time," Fyodor said. "Yes, we have a lot of material, but to assemble it with so few people is difficult. Atmosphere is growing. Drag is increasing. Orbit is decaying."
Dinah looked across the table at Reese. Reese, the biomimetic engineer, the man who had perhaps saved Ymir with his idea of turning robots into little radiation-resistant Ben Grimms. "We'll build it out of ice," Dinah said. Reese looked up at her, pondered it for a second, and nodded.
"Too brittle," Fyodor said.
"I don't think Dinah's speaking of regular ice," Reese said. "She means the pycrete stuff they used on Ymir. Fiber-reinforced ice. It worked to hold the shard together. We can make it work here."
Moira spoke up.
"Perhaps I'm missing something, but I was under the impression that the ice was our propellant. Aren't we going to melt it and consume it as we go along?"
"Yes,"
Doob said.
"And doesn't that mean that we'll be consuming the structure that's holding everything together?"
"Yes," Doob repeated, "but it's okay. Because the more of it we use, the lighter we get, and the less thrust we need. So it's okay to sacrifice some structure as we go along."
Sal had been listening intently.
"I don't mean to throw cold water on the idea," he said.
The pun, assuming he meant it as such, elicited a few groans.
"But we've been hearing about radioactive contamination."
"On the outer surface of the shard, yes," Dinah said. "Microscopic motes of stuff that is super radioactive, stuck to the ice. Beta won't penetrate our living spaces.
We'll have to be careful, though, not to track it inside. We can program robots to crawl around, look for those hot moats, and get rid of them over time. Sal looked unconvinced. I won't lie to you, Dinah said. People are going to die of it.
But the trade is as follows, Rhys said. Izzy already has a massive battering ram of nickel iron on her snout. Her flanks are vulnerable, as we learned today. Now we have the ability to shroud everything, the entire space station, in reinforced ice. Oh, it will dwindle over time. But through most of the big ride, we'll be living deep inside of a gigantic iceberg with a steel nose. I submit that the death toll from possible contamination will be minor compared to what we would experience if we went on the same journey unprotected.
What do you need to make it happen? Ivy asked.
Permission, Dinah said.
When did you ever ask for that before?
The joke elicited a high-pitched laugh from the corner of the conference room.
Heads turned toward Camilla.
Camilla,
Ivy said. We've hardly heard a word from you since we found you in the shipyard. One of our witnesses there claims you may have saved Tekla's life. You had the opportunity to escape with Julia. Instead, you stayed behind to free the bound shipyard workers. You saved their lives. Now you're here among us. You must know how this looks.
The look on Camilla's face made it clear that how it looked
had never crossed her mind. She didn't even get what Ivy was saying.
Dear, Louisa said, people are going to say you are a spy who volunteered to be left behind.
Camilla held up a closed fist
and opened it to reveal a small white plastic box, loose tape still dangling from it.
Julia's bug, she announced. It was here.
No one looked very convinced.
She invited me to dinner at the White House, Camilla said. She helped me pick out a dress. She introduced me to generals, ambassadors, movie stars. She wrote me letters on White House stationery. I was in love with her. You can call me naive if you want. All right. I was naive. Until this morning. And then, all of a sudden, I saw. I saw what I was dealing with. I hate her now. And I hate myself for having been in love with her.
Best remember that, sweetheart, Moira said, because she made the wrong choice today, and sooner or later, she'll be coming back.
I'll be ready,
Camilla said.
Endurance. Seen by human eyes, the hollow hulk of Ymir's ice shard was as dead, brittle, and gleaming as the discarded carapace of a beetle. Captured through the electronic eyes of cameras, then speeded up 100,000-fold so that the events of one day were compressed into 1 second of video, it looked like an amoeba pursuing, capturing, and swallowing Izzy. A person with no preconceptions of what they were watching would perceive Izzy as a steel-headed insect, all legs and pods and antennas, twitching and kicking in an effort to defend itself from the slow, relentless, liquid onslaught of the ice monster. In truth, of course, the 400 survivors, moving at lightning speed compared with the slow evolutions of the ice, were reconfiguring the space station in preparation for the big ride. The crippled caboose was cut free, and the components of the shipyard moved forward. The big power reactor was brought in close to the stack. From now on, they would rely on ice to shield the rest of Izzy from its radiation. The 81 arclets arranged themselves into 9 groups of 9 and were tacked into place at the aft end, nozzles aimed backward. The structural works holding them into place at first were flimsy trellises on which spacewalkers could string cables, propellant lines, and hamster tubes. As soon as those were in place, the ice caught up with them. Driven forward by the ceaseless operations of a giant gnat swarm, and the arclets were gradually cemented into place,
within a solid matrix of the fiber-reinforced ice known as Picrete. Forward the ice flowed. It was like watching video of a melting iceberg played in reverse. The gnats, blindly following a simple collection of rules, packed it into every vacant space they happened upon. In the few minutes out of each day when the crew could take some rest and eat some rations, they would try to top each other, telling funny stories about where they had found a living infestation of ice and what they had done to beat it back. Within a month, the remnants of Ymir had all been consumed, and Izzy had seemingly ceased to exist. The two of them had merged into an orbiting mountain. Its summit was a battered and scarified lump of nickel iron, hazy with angular scaffolding where antennas and sensors were mounted. Its slopes were a smooth rampart of black ice, interrupted here and there by outcroppings of thrusters or other equipment, observation domes peeking out like hermit's huts. Its base was a plane decorated with a neat grid of 81 small holes from which blue fire erupted from time to time as the ship passed through her perigee. They couldn't make out what to call the thing. People tried and failed to combine the words Izzy and Ymir. The closest they came was Izmir, but that had been the name of a city in Turkey. Sentiment was in favor of naming her after the martyrs of the Ymir expedition, but there had been several. In honor of Marcus, it was likened to the Daubenhorn, later shortened to the Horn, which was not a bad nickname. But the name that stuck was a continuation of the Shackleton theme that Marcus had established with New Caird. Shackleton's big ship had been called Endurance, and was famous for having gotten stuck in the ice. So Endurance it was, and Fyodor christened her thus by getting into his battered Orlan, climbing out onto the surface of Amalthea, and dashing a bottle of champagne against the metal. A more distant camera, looking down on Earth from a high above the North Pole and watching the career of Endurance over the next years, would have seen a nail-biter of an opening, followed by endless, grinding tedium, slowly building to a dramatic final reel. Prior to Ymir's arrival, the Cloud Ark's pilots had put no small amount of attention into the problem of keeping Izzy out of the expanding atmosphere. This produced greater drag, which Amalthea, with its high ballistic coefficient, was well made to resist. But the decay of her orbit had to be mended from time to time with burns of the big engine that in those days had lived on the aft end of the caboose, fueled by the shipyard's reactor-powered splitters. The break, as they called the event when the big bolide had smashed into Izzy, and the Swarm and Red Hope had gone their separate ways, had put an end to all that. Between then and the day about a month later when Endurance was christened, she spiraled gradually downward. Had the featherweight arklets tried to keep formation with her, they'd have been pushed back by the wind. They were forced to creep into the lee of Amalthea and ride along within her bow wave, like bicyclists slipstreaming behind a truck, until they could be integrated into the framework of the ship. Down and down she spiraled, and the SI team had to send grabs out onto the forward trusswork and remove the fragile antennas and sensors mounted there, lest they be slowly burned off by a rarefied but white-hot wind blast. Fyodor's champagne spacewalk was a brief one, and when he got back inside, he reported that he could see the spraying foam of the champagne being blown backward by the atmosphere. Their mission was to move their apogee from where it was now, just a few kilometers higher than the altitude of the perigee, all the way out to the altitude of Cleft, some 378,000 kilometers more distant. It was a reversal of the maneuvers that Marcus, Dinah, Jiro, and Vyacheslav had executed in order to bring Ymir into orbital sync with Izzy. The way to achieve it was to burn the engines for brief intervals as Endurance made her regular swings through perigee. The first of those burns happened about 30 minutes after she was christened, and yielded a delta V of 4 meters per second. The acceleration was so mild that most of the crew could not even sense it. for the combined thrust of 81 Arklet engines was nearly powerless against the bulk of Endurance, with her roughly equal masses of iron and ice. Nonetheless, it was enough to boost her apogee, which occurred some 46 minutes later, by 14.18 kilometers. And 46 minutes after that, another burn during another scrape with the atmosphere gained them another 4 meters per second that, at the ensuing apogee, added 14.21 kilometers on top of that. The result of Endurance's first day of operations was a boost in apogee altitude of more than 100 kilometers, enough to get them clear of the expanded atmosphere except during the few minutes each orbit when they swung through the perigee. After that, however, they had to suspend operations, since they'd used up all the propellant stored in the shipyard's ice-buried tanks. They needed to give the reactor and the splitters some time to catch up. Even a nuclear power plant could split water only so fast. Not long after, the operation was shut down for a week by problems in feeding clean water to the system. For another month, it could only operate at about a quarter of its planned capacity. But over time, they worked the bugs out and began to burn the engines more and more at each perigee, gradually extending Endurance's reach toward Cleft. If they could keep it up, that reach would get less gradual over time. The first Delta V had gained them 14.18 kilometers. The second equivalent Delta V had reaped 14.21 kilometers, an improvement of about 30 meters. These gains were tiny in comparison to the distances of outer space, but from a mathematical standpoint, the trend was extremely significant. It meant that the higher they went, the more elongated the orbit became, the more leverage they could obtain from each one of those tiny delta Vs. That difference of 30 meters would grow and grow until it spanned many kilometers. And each of those improvements would feed back into the equations and amplify the next result a little bit more. It was an exponential sort of phenomenon. And this time, humanity was on the right side of it. This didn't even take into account another piece of good mathematical news, which was that Endurance grew a little bit lighter with each one of those burns. She had less mass with which to resist the force of the thrusters, and so it gradually became possible to produce more than a piddling 4 meters per second of delta V on each turn around the planet. So everything was going to get better, if they could stay alive and keep Endurance working. But these gains accrued painfully slowly at the beginning. It ended up taking 3 years. They had planned for one. It took longer because things kept breaking and needed to be fixed. The tools and supplies needed to fix them weren't always available. Sometimes they had to be improvised. Elaborate workarounds had to be devised through the force of human ingenuity, hard work, and, when all else failed, the risking and the sacrifice of lives. The human capital of Endurance dwindled. They were always short on food. Arklets were designed to grow their own food supplies in their translucent outer hulls. But Endurance's arklets were buried in ice to protect them from the hard rain. The ones near the outside got enough sunlight to produce some food, but not enough compared to the mouths that had to be fed. She began her journey well-stocked with emergency provisions, which were rationed out on a schedule that assumed a mission length of 1 year. As it became clear that the journey would go on much longer, the rations were cut back. Endurance also had abundant stockpiles of vitamins, most of which had survived the break. These were sought after by the people of the swarm, who had flown the coop without stockpiling enough of them. Trade began to happen between Endurance and the swarm, but it wasn't the free market that the swarmamentalists had once envisioned. Deals were negotiated over the radio and consummated by exchanges between MIVs and Arklets, difficult to arrange because of the need to match orbits that had now become very different. As they had done with Ymir, they mined ice from the interior volume of Endurance, leaving the outer walnut shell
as a structural support and as a first line of defense against bolides. But as JBF and other dump-and-run partisans had never tired of pointing out, such a heavy craft lacked maneuverability. When a big rock was seen far enough in advance, they could use her engines to make small course changes that would have large outcomes by the time the rock came close. Doing so was the full-time occupation of most of Endurance's complement, which worked at it 3 shifts a day. But below a certain threshold, they could not see rocks soon enough or maneuver out of their way quickly enough, and then they just had to hope that the bolide would strike Amalthea. Most did, but some hit the icy lower slopes, and of those, some struck with enough power to penetrate and kill. Suicide took about 1 in 10 over the course of the 3-year journey. Sometimes this was for traditional reasons. After a great burst of creative activity during the weeks when Endurance was being designed and crafted, Rhys fell into a black depression and took his own life a month into the voyage. In other cases, a spacewalker agreed to go on what was clearly a suicide mission, or a patient suffering from cancer decided to end her life rather than create a drain on limited resources of food, air, and medical supplies. And there was quite a bit of cancer, for Dinah's prediction on the day of the break had been borne out. In spite of all precautions, particles of fallout made their way into the air and the food chain and lodged in lungs and guts. Even without this, the environment of space, with its ambient radiation, lack of exercise, poor diet, and exposure to various chemicals, tended to jack up the cancer rate. Endurance's medical facilities were not up to the job of detecting and treating cancer in the way people had been used to on Earth. Periodic crises in the supplies of food and air, caused by blights in the greenhouses or breakdowns in equipment, took away people whose strength had been sapped to begin with. The journey entailed thousands of traversals of the Van Allen radiation belts. Rather than passing through these but 1 or 2 times, as might have been the case in a more traditional space voyage, they had to do it 2 on each orbit. And during the 1st year, they were, for all practical purposes, never out of them. They sheltered as much as they could in shielded parts of the ship, but no shelter was perfect. Some of the crew were obliged, by duty or by happenstance, to remain in exposed locations. And the mere fact of being crammed together in a confined space for a significant fraction of the time was a drag on health. The gender ratio began to skew even more toward females. The general population, whose break-surviving members had made up roughly 1/4 of Endurance's original complement, had been predominantly male. This was a simple consequence of the fact that they had been drawn from traditionally male-dominated professions, such as the military, the astronaut corps, and science and engineering. The other 3/4 had been Arkies. The original Arkie population had been 75% female and 25% male. The ones who had elected to stay with Endurance at the time of the break were more strongly skewed toward women. The men tended to be older, in many cases 2 or even 3 times the age of the Arkies. Compared to the Arkies, who had mostly been sent up at the last minute, they tended to have been in space and subject to its health effects for much longer. They had been picked for brains, not for physical fitness. At least at the beginning, while the Arkies were still learning the ropes, they tended to draw the most hazardous duty, such as spacewalks. And men simply were not as well suited to life in space. They were more biologically vulnerable to radiation. They needed more air and more food. And whether it was the result of cultural upbringing or genetic programming, they simply were not cut out psychologically for the idea that they were going to spend the rest of their lives in crowded indoor spaces. Many of them felt an urge to go outside and get away from people that manifested itself as a tendency to volunteer for more spacewalks. People who went on spacewalks were much more likely to die of radiation exposure,
Bolide strikes. Equipment malfunction, misadventure, or contamination by reactor fallout. As well, there was an understanding, widely shared but rarely spoken of, that men were not the scarce resource. Women, to be specific, healthy, functional wombs, were. Acting on that belief, or perhaps just electing a more socially constructive form of suicide, Min continued volunteering for hazard duty, instinctively herding the women toward the protected interior spaces of the ship. And when the women objected, as some did, they were apt to be shut down by the simple, hard-to-argue-with assertion that their lives and health had to be preserved at all costs. Communication with the swarm was sporadic and tended to come in bursts when the swarm needed something. The groups had separated under conditions that would have been deemed a state of war had the break not happened in the midst of a catastrophe more deadly than anything that one side could have inflicted upon the other with force of arms. Neither side was likely to begin trusting the other anytime soon. Free, internet-style communication between them was forbidden on both sides, since it could have been used for purposes that were mischievous or worse. The channel between Swarm and Endurance was more akin to a hotline linking two Cold War capitals. It went unused for months at a time. This was not so much a matter of the two sides snubbing each other, as it was that they were both fully occupied trying to stay alive. Ivy and JBF were like the captains of two damaged ships, many miles apart in stormy seas, with other things on their minds. When the channel was used, it was to negotiate terms of exchanges between the two groups. Neither side was of a mind to share much information about its status. But much could be inferred from the things that the swarm urgently asked for, mostly propellant, but also the sort of medicine used to treat radiation sickness, blight-resistant strains of food crops, nutrients, spare parts for CO2 scrubbers, and for the Stirling engines that supplied power to Arklets. In exchange, they offered mostly food, which was the only thing they could make that Endurance didn't already have. 11 weeks following the break, a solar flare had occurred, followed by an event known as a coronal mass ejection, a vast release of charged particles hurled out from the sun into the solar system. With its array of sensors, some of which were always pointed toward the sun for just this reason, Endurance had seen the storm coming and had sent a warning message to the swarm. In those days, Endurance had been well inside the protection of the Earth's magnetosphere. That, plus the shielding provided by iron and ice, had enabled her crew to ride out the storm with little exposure to its radiation. They had no way of knowing, though, whether the swarm had even received or understood the warning. The danger of coronal mass ejections had been well understood by the architects, who had provided storm shelters in each Arklet. Sleeping bags, in effect, made so that water could be pumped into the space between their inner and outer walls, surrounding the occupant with molecules that were good at absorbing high-energy protons. The Arklets were also stocked with doses of a drug called amifostine, which protected DNA from damage produced by the free radicals generated in the body by radiation exposure. The scheme was a good one, provided the Arkies had at least half an hour's advance warning and enough water in their Arklets' tanks to fill up all the shelters. They practiced it every so often, as sailors would perform lifeboat drills. But there was a lot that could go wrong, and it seemed unlikely that all 800 Arkies had made it through the storm unscathed. In the ensuing 3 years, there had been 10 more coronal mass ejections big enough to worry about. The Endurance had transmitted a warning to the swarm in each of those cases, but never received an acknowledgement. It was worrisome that the swarm always seemed to want more water. Since the water of an Arklet's ecosystem was recycled, the only way the Arklet could lose it was by expending it as propellant, splitting it into hydrogen and oxygen, and feeding it to a thruster. All the arklets in a swarm would have to do this from time to time, simply in order to remain in formation. That was true even if they never dodged a rock and never changed their orbit around the Earth. But it seemed that they had changed their orbit on several occasions, making it higher and more circular to keep it clear of the Van Allen belts. Presumably they had their reasons for doing so. But if they ran so low on water that they couldn't fill their storm shelters when needed, they were open to a disaster that might kill most or all of them at a stroke. Ivy could only assume that they were still reasonable people, and that if things got that bad, they would call for help. In the meantime, she tried to guard against the seductive idea that Endurance had all the water it could ever need. There weren't going to be any more Ymir expeditions. The water they carried with them might be all that the human race had to live on for hundreds of years. She had already made up her mind what she would say if JBF ever contacted her with an urgent demand for storm shelter water. Nothing doing. Come to us, rejoin the crew of Endurance, and take shelter here. She wondered, sometimes, if JBF had anticipated that Ivy would make such a demand, and just how far she was willing to go to avoid such an unconditional surrender.
Well, that was hard,
Doob croaked, then wetted his whistle with a swig of the Ardbeg, mixed with a few drops of 5-billion-year-old asteroid water. He was in the banana, speaking to an empty room, staring up at a projection screen on the wall. His reading glasses no longer worked. Zero gravity had changed the shape of his eyeballs. The people who knew how to operate the lens-grinding machine were all dead or missing, so there was no way to make new eyeglasses until someone figured out where the machine had been squirreled away and read the instruction manual. Since only 28 people remained alive on Endurance, this didn't look like it would happen any time soon. His distance vision was still pretty good, but because of the problem with the glasses, he didn't like to use his laptop for long periods of time. Instead, he would come here to the banana, soak up a little gravity, plug the computer into the projector cable, and work at long range. He had been here for an hour because he didn't want to miss the big moment. He knew exactly when that moment would occur, plus or minus a few seconds. But in the meantime, he couldn't concentrate on anything else. The other 27 were asleep or busy, so he was celebrating alone. The display in front of him was dominated by a single large window displaying 6 numbers in fat, easy-to-read block letters. These were the orbital parameters of Endurance. They were updated several times a second, the numbers blurring and twitching. The one he was focusing on was labeled R, short for radius. It was the distance separating Endurance from the center of Earth. At the moment, it was the highest it had ever been, at 384,512,933 meters, and still climbing, slowly, in the last few digits. Endurance was creeping toward apogee, the highest apogee she had ever attained, and the height of that apogee was slightly beyond the distance at which the moon had once orbited Earth. For the first time, they were as high in the sky now as Cleft. Loose objects shifted position as Endurance's remaining engines came on. They were down to 37 functioning arclet engines from the original complement of 81. On a good day, they could muster 39. The other half of them had been cannibalized to keep the good ones working. To compensate for the losses, they had jury-rigged all the other engines they could get. The big one from the caboose, all the propulsion units that had once been part of the shipyard, and a few spare motors from straggler arclets that had become separated from the swarm and found a way to rejoin them. Despite the reduction in engine power, Endurance was at least as maneuverable now as she had been at the beginning, when she had wallowed at the bottom of Earth's gravity well, burdened with years' worth of propellant. She weighed half as much now as she had in those days. The burn went on for a while,
It concluded with a change in attitude and a burn in another direction. Doob didn't have to read the numbers on the screen to know what they were doing. They'd been planning it for 3 years. They were in a highly eccentric orbit now, a pair of hairpin turns welded together by straightaways a third of a million kilometers long. Earth nestled deep in the crook of one of those hairpins. Endurance's perigee hadn't changed in 3 years. On every one of the thousands of orbits they had made, they had screamed across the top of Earth's atmosphere while running their engines full blast. On the last such pass, which they'd made about 5 days ago, they'd topped out at more than 11,000 meters per second of velocity. The visual symmetry of the orbit was deceptive. At their current location, the opposite hairpin, now slightly beyond the old moon's orbit, they were crawling along at a speed that could have been matched, back in the day, by a wheeled vehicle on a salt flat. They were like a car on a roller coaster that had been towed all the way to the top and that was creeping along at that moment before it begins the plunge down to the bottom. The Earth was the size of a ping-pong ball at arm's length. Soon they'd begin falling toward it, building back up toward 11,000 meters per second during their next perigee pass, 5 days from now. In the meantime, though, during these few minutes when they were just inching along, they could work magic. Small changes in velocity out here led to enormous transformations in their orbit down there. Endurance, by dint of enduring for 3 years and persevering in her plan, had reached Clef's distance from Earth. But she'd always been in the wrong plane, the same plane that Izzy had started out in, the plane that had been chosen seemingly a million years ago because it was easily reached from the Baikonur Cosmodrome. Down there, deep in the gravity well, changing that plane would have been catastrophically expensive. If they'd had an Earth to go back to, it would have been cheaper to start from scratch and build a new space station than to move Izzy to the plane where the moon had once orbited. Up here, though, by burning the engines at Apogee, they could nudge it closer and closer to the desired plane at much lower cost. So they'd been doing little plane change maneuvers at each apogee. It had been going on for months now. It was a thing that had to happen if they were ever to reach Cleft. But it made Doob's stomach burn, made him wish he hadn't had a couple of slugs of hoarded single malt. For the plane of the old moon, the place they had to go to find safe refuge in Cleft, was where all the rocks were. That was where the rocks had started out, at zero. And for the most part, that was where they had stayed. The ones that had fallen to Earth in the hard rain were only a tiny fraction of the lunar debris cloud, just a faint dusting compared to what had remained up here. During most of Endurance's journey, her pilots had, by choice, kept her in that angled Baikonur-compatible plane, well clear of the moon's debris field. Otherwise, they could never have survived for this long. But the risk that they had to accept in order to try for Cleft was to fly through the debris cloud in which Cleft swam. Every time they had reached an apogee in the last few months and burned their engines to bring their orbit closer to the plane of their destination, they had edged into dirtier and more dangerous space. Their slowness was part of the problem. If the debris cloud was a fleet of cars roaring around a circular raceway at top speed, then Endurance was a child toddling out into traffic. That extreme disparity in speed would remain until the next apogee, 10 days from now, when they would make their biggest and longest burn, expending all of Endurance's remaining propellant to accelerate her to the same average speed as the debris cloud. In doing so, they'd convert the dual hairpin orbit into a nearly perfect circle, remaining 384,000,000 512,933 meters from Earth, forever. Having merged smoothly with the traffic on the circular raceway, they would go hunting for Cleft. Doob had spied it several times on his optical telescopes, gotten a fix on its params, knew how to find it. This was his life's work. If he'd been asked several years ago, before Zero, he'd have said it was something else. But his life until Day 360 had been nothing more than preparation for the mission plan he had laid in and was now executing for Endurance. The day of the break, the arrival of the propellant needed, the death of his friend and colleague Conrad, and the sundering of the swarm, had made it clear what needed to be done and who needed to do it. So he'd been doing it. 10 days remained until they were swimming in the debris cloud. Perhaps a fortnight before they reached Cleft. He wondered if he would live to see it. Quite obviously, he had cancer. Diagnostic facilities were lacking, but the first undeniable symptoms had been in his digestive tract. And since then, his liver had become swollen by metastases. Now he was feeling some weird stuff in his lungs. It had grown slowly. It might have been natural causes, something that had been seeded on old Earth before he had even come to space. Or it might have been a piece of fallout that had made its way into his food and gotten caught in his gut. No matter. The main question on his mind was whether he would live to see Cleft. He actually didn't feel that bad, and so the naive answer would be, yes, of course. But cancer growth was something of an exponential phenomenon, and he knew how tricky those could be. Bolor Erdina was flying the ship, working in the Hammerhead, the deeply sheltered control room that they had built into the lee side of Amalthea. Or at least, she was on the duty roster as the nominal pilot. Distinctions of rank and specialty had ceased to matter much. Everyone who had survived, 9 men and 19 women, knew how to do everything. Fly the ship, fix an arclet engine, go on a spacewalk, program a robot. The Doob of a few years ago would have ridden it out in the Hammerhead with her, looking over her shoulder, checking the params, swapping witty remarks in the occasional moment of downtime. The Doob sitting in the banana right now had seen it all before, thousands of times, and knew that it was as routine to Bo or to any of the survivors as driving to work would have been before Zero. Being there would have only gotten his stomach riled up. He needed to conserve his energy. He realized that he had dozed off. Opening his eyes and focusing, with some effort, on the screen, he saw that nearly an hour had passed since apogee. They were falling toward Earth for the last time. His phone rang. Held at arm's length, it was blurry, but some vestigial part of his brain could still recognize the smear of pixels as a snapshot of Bo, taken years ago. He swiped it on and answered it.
"We are being contacted by the swarm," Bo said.
"Are we really?"
he answered. Suddenly he was awake.
"What does JBF want?"
"It's not JBF. It's someone named..."
Bo paused.
"Aida, or something. 2 dots on the I."
Doob tried to place the name. Aida. He had a vague memory of her from his early days on the Cloud Ark. An Italian girl. Young. Arky, not G-pop. Socially a little weird. Hyper-acute in a way that could be exhausting.
"It's pronounced Aida,"
he told Bo.
"Anyway, they send congratulations on the successful completion of our maneuver and request a parley. Should I wake up Ivy?"
"I'll be there in a minute,"
Doob said.
"Let her sleep."
He hated to think this way, but the swarmers well knew what time it was and which shift Ivy slept on, and that she was sleeping now. Rousting her out of bed would send the wrong message, making the crew of Endurance seem overeager, which might have been an excess of caution. A JBF-style exercise of Byzantine thinking, he reflected, as he pushed himself up the middle of the stack. This had become a dingy place, sort of yellowed and shiny with human exhalations, condensed on its ice-cold walls and never really scrubbed off. He was glad he couldn't see it very well. They knew so little about the swarm. From the straggler arclets they'd picked up over the last 3 years, they knew that JBF had moved swiftly to consolidate her power, exploiting the crisis of the first coronal mass ejection, which had killed something like 10% of the population, to set up her own version of martial law. From there, the trains had run more or less on time, albeit with a steadily dwindling population, until about a year ago, when some Arkis had begun to rebel, and the swarm had divided into two swarms, coexisting with each other, as they had little choice, but not talking. The people of Endurance had paid surprisingly little attention to matters swarm-related, because, in the end, it didn't really matter that much. The die had been cast on the day of the break, not so much on the level of politics as on physics. Those who had stayed behind on Izzy had committed themselves to following Doob's plan, his life's work, the big ride. You were either aboard Endurance, simultaneously trapped and protected by her mass, or you weren't. If you were, there was no getting off. If you weren't, you had to find a way to survive as part of the swarm, which meant moving to a completely different orbit and following a plan that was incompatible on an orbital mechanics level with the big ride. Once those orbits had diverged, the only way to reconnect was by affecting a big delta V. That meant spending a lot of water that you were never going to get back. Less water meant less shielding from coronal mass ejections, limited food production, and hobbled maneuvering when bad rocks came at you. Getting a whole swarm to agree on that course of action was impossible and might actually have been a bad idea, since Endurance couldn't accommodate a lot of refugees. Her mission plan was predicated on her ability to absorb significant bolide strikes without taking serious damage. A bunch of naked arclets following in her wake would soon get beaten to death. So on a physics level alone, the break had been irrevocable, even had the two groups badly wanted to get together. But apparently what was left of the swarm had been watching Endurance, biding their time, waiting to see whether she would win through. This Aida person must understand Doob's plan. She knew what was at stake now. If the remnants of the swarm could rejoin Endurance in the next 10 days, before she disappeared into the maelstrom of the debris cloud, they had a hope of reaching the comparative safety of Cleft. Otherwise, they were condemned to circle Earth in some relatively clean and safe orbit as their population and their water supply dwindled. Doob swam into the Hammerhead. 3 other people were in here. Beau, Steve Lake, and Michael Park, a former Arkie, a gay Korean-Canadian from Vancouver who had found 6 different ways to make himself indispensable. Aida Ferrari, according to our records, Beau said before he asked, a leader of the anti-JBF faction. Sounds like JBF lost. Steve seemed busy. It was good to see him active. He had come down with some kind of long-running bowel complaint, an imbalance in the bacteria that lived in his gut. He had kept the dreadlocks, but they were now bigger than he was. He must weigh less than 100 pounds, but his fingers still flew over the keys of his laptop. Beau had already turned her attention back to the business of running the ship, but Michael explained,
Steve's getting a video feed going. No one's done it in years.
He meant that no one had recently been doing it over the old-school S-band radios used for long-range communication between space vehicles. Of course, on the short-range mesh network that the architects had set up to knit the cloud arc together, people did it all the time using SCAPE. But depending on where they were in their orbit, the remnants of the swarm might be hundreds of thousands of kilometers away from Endurance, far out of mesh range. And so they had to use the same sort of pre-internet technology that the Apollo astronauts had used to send television signals back from the moon. Eventually, Steve did get it going, and then they were treated to a full face image, in blocky pixels, of a dark-eyed woman with a fine-featured head that had been buzz-cut a few weeks ago, and little tended since. Once Steve did him the favor of throwing it up on a big screen where he could actually see it, Dube saw the obvious signs of malnutrition that had been affecting everyone on Endurance. He was mildly surprised by that. They had tantalized themselves by imagining the swarm as a